Don, I just paid my annual premium for my life insurance. And I got that life insurance probably 10 years ago. And it was before I knew, I was still a runner 10 years ago, but I didn't know that there were different rates for healthier people. Mm. Health IQ has been something that has come out since then that aligns A-rated life insurance companies with healthy people to give them the best rates possible.
So let's break it down, Scott. Did you save some money when you compared your rates?
I haven't. Yes, I've saved money. And I think that everybody else should too by going to healthiq.com/TRN. Now we're going to take a quiz.
I'm ready. Another quiz.
This is about transitioning from treadmill to the outdoors.
Oh, now these are the quizzes that they send every once in a while.
Periodically, just to help us increase our knowledge of health.
And stay healthy. Go ahead. Right. I'm ready.
Okay. Running outside increases damage for UV rays. Aside from sunscreen, what can help protect against UV damage such as skin lesions? A, rubbing oatmeal on the skin.
No, I'm not going to do it.
Or B, shorts and short sleeves. Yeah. 3, a diet high in antioxidants.
Yes.
Or D, running in the early afternoon.
I'm going to say high diet in antioxidants.
That is absolutely correct, all Mr.
Right,
Freeman.
All right. Nice. And for the record, I can't see the screen.
No,
I
you
don't
can't.
Know the answers.
You're going
Go
on.
Ahead.
Okay.
I'm not rubbing oatmeal on me.
Here's the next one. Prior to running outdoors, the Mayo Clinic recommends contacting a government agency to obtain what information?
A permit.
A map. Nearest emergency department.
Yeah,
this is silly.
That's good.
2, the weather forecast. 3, skincare information, or 4, local air quality.
I'd say just local air quality, probably pretty important.
That's actually right.
Yeah.
And the last question for this session. Some people like to run barefoot outdoors.
Well, yes, you should.
Proponents claim barefoot running has what advantages over running with shoes? A, more ankle stability.
Yes.
B, heel absorbs more force.
Oh, no, we know that's wrong.
C, forefoot absorbs more force.
It does.
And D, less painful.
I'm going to go with C.
The forefoot absorbs more force. That is absolutely correct.
Ooh,
now,
you
qualify for being a healthy runner. You should qualify for better life insurance rates. Go to healthiq.com/TRN.
Scott, on this podcast, we talked to Devin Yanko about one of her performances out at Javelina 100.
Yeah, and we talked about nutrition. We said, what kind of nutrition? She's a baker, so she can really cook up really anything she wants. She knows food ingredients, and she said she keeps it simple. In fact, at that race, all she took in the entire race was Tailwind Nutrition.
And she wasn't out there very long, 14:52. I mean, that's very fast. But Tailwind Nutrition was her go-to product. That's all she had all day.
It gave her the electrolytes. It gave her the hydration. It gave her the calories. Easily digestible with little stomach distress.
And multiple flavors. I mean, the green tea is my favorite. They have a flavor called Naked, which doesn't taste like anything.
It's not a flavor.
And the orange and then lemon. And
there's caffeinated. There's non-caffeinated.
Good stuff.
And you can mix and match. And make your own flavor.
And it mixes well, not only in your stomach, but in your bottle too. Good stuff.
Go to our partners page and link on over to Tailwind Nutrition, or you can go to tailwindnutrition.com and order some up for you today.
Ladies and gentlemen of the wide, worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest trail running nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
The problem with the message above is that it flies in the face of what we know to be true.
We'll
Candace, we are such idiots. You don't even you have no idea.
No, I've listened to your podcast for many years, and it's
I do own my own bar. Every Friday morning on I Run Far, we open up and open up the taps.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Don Freeman.
I'm Scott Ward.
No, wait. It was Andy. Andy goes.
Oh, Andy's next. I'm last.
So here we go.
Okay.
Scott, you're the topic introducer
this
time.
Okay.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
Andy Jones-Wilkins.
Devin Yanko.
And I'm Scott War. And there's an adjective that is in the Webster's Dictionary called stubborn. And it defines stubborn as having or showing dogged determination not to change one's attitude or position on something, especially in spite of good arguments or reasons to do so. Today's podcast is about the word stubborn. Is it a good thing or is it a bad thing for ultra running?
Yeah, that's where we're going to kick this thing off. AJW, you were with us on a previous philosophical podcast, and the word stubborn came up, and we felt that was a good one to talk about. Have you been putting some thought to this word stubborn?
I have, and I'm intrigued by the concept of taking these words and ideas that are historically seen as negatives mm-hmm. in regular life, and coming to a little bit better understanding of how they might be positives in our running lives. And this one we talked about vulnerability, for example, a couple of months ago. And I think that there are times that this idea of being stubborn is seen as just something that's a negative. And I know after a couple of decades in this sport that some of the best runners I've met are quite stubborn and quite proud of it. And so I thought it'd be an interesting topic to bounce around with you guys and Devin today, because we're getting into the summer race season and dialing in our training, and it's a time where being stubborn pays off more than most.
Hey Devin, when I mentioned the word stubborn to you, what came to your mind initially? Was it a negative connotation or a positive connotation?
It was both, actually, because I think for women, stubbornness is often seen as a very negative thing. Women are taught to be collaborative and agreeable. And so I think that women who are stubborn in everyday life are often thought of as difficult. But I also, one of the things that I think I've actually learned to cultivate through ultra running is more stubbornness. And that stubbornness comes out of learning lessons and realizing that sometimes when I think I'm at my limits or I think I'm done, that I actually have the wherewithal and the knowledge to say, hey, I have the experience to know I can go past this point. And so the stubbornness then comes in to say, like, I'm not going to give in to this thought process. I'm going to go beyond that. So it becomes a super positive thing.
Devin, that's an interesting point that I didn't think of. Do you think that stubborn as it applies to men and women is different enough that women are expected to temper that emotion more than men?
Absolutely.
That's interesting to me.
I've had some interactions recently where I've seen that in groups of women and the way that women are perceived, it's like if a woman is stubborn or holds her position, it's seen as a very negative thing, and it's actually almost been treated like it's a masculine quality. So it's like the being stubborn is almost women who are stubborn are almost told that they're aggressive or that they're doing something that's more of a masculine trait. So I definitely think that there is a big disparity where I think for men it's actually, and even like boys, it's actually cultivated as kind of a part of their persona in a different way.
You brought up just a moment ago, stubborn only becomes useful when mixed with experience. I may have paraphrased that a bit, but AJW, speak to that point. Stubborn only becomes useful when mixed with experience.
If I may, I'd love to just follow up on Devin's gender comment about stubborn and the different ways it's perceived as a quality that might be negative or positive for both genders, because I see it cultivated from a very young, that stereotype cultivated from a very young age as an educator. Just for example, just reading through report card comments from teachers, innocent, well-meaning teachers, by the way, no intended bias, where the tone of the commentary might suggest that the boy who is dogged and determined and somewhat stubborn, is actually, that's a positive trait. Whereas the girl, same girl in the same class, 12 years old perhaps, is therefore inflexible or perhaps not willing to be a part of the group, which I see as a challenge as an educator and as a person. With respect to Devin's comment on experience, absolutely. I think that when we experience life through running, inevitably, especially since, as Devin and I have been at it for, you know, a while, inevitably we find those moments where you just have to soldier through, where you have to force yourself to do something that you didn't necessarily think you wanted to do, didn't think you'd have to do, didn't sometimes think you'd even should do. And those experiences of having stubbornness push you through once makes it a lot easier the second time and the third time and the fourth time. So that by the time you've, you know, run, 100 ultras or so, you know that that moment's going to come when you have to just put everything else aside and get it done. And being stubborn, being determined, being persistent, and having had those experiences, not just in running, but in the rest of your life, will certainly help you get out the other side.
Yeah, you know, pushing the stubborn button at the wrong time can drive you straight into a cliff or right into a hole that you can't climb out of. But but pushing the stubborn button when you need it to kick yourself in the behind and say, let's push through this. This is going to get better. This is one of those things you can work through instead of, you know, holding back and recovering in that respect. I think that is experience talking. That makes the wily veteran runner, knowing when to apply some stubbornness. Scott?
You know, I agree with you. And I think that a veteran runner that has successful experiences can then rely on their stubbornness. But I think that it can become detrimental if they lose perspective. So if you have, you know, we talk about, what's the phrase? A sophomore, I think you brought it up.
The sophomore jinx.
The sophomore jinx, where you may have gone out and been successful at a couple race distances, and you go into it with this maybe misconception of success, and you go out there and you're stubborn and you lose perspective, where it can actually turn on you in a negative way.
You're almost overconfident.
What do you think about that, Devin?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that stubbornness alone can be a replacement for all the other things that it takes to get you to the finish line. Like, I think it's a valuable trait, but it also can lead you to make decisions that are basically like not founded on any sort of like, you know, any training or anything else, where you're just like, well, I did it once before, so I know I can do it. Well, it's not how it necessarily works. And that's why I think the experience, it's like pulling from the experience and knowing almost when to be stubborn. And I think that does evolve. And I think like, it's actually interesting because my Western States experiences illustrate that, because when I did my first Western States, I had issues and I didn't have the experience to be stubborn enough. Like, I literally, in my head, I was just like, I shouldn't drop. But that wasn't enough motivation. And so when I got into a really bad place, like, I didn't have that stubbornness. I didn't have that resilience to say, this bad thing is happening and I can come out the other side. So I didn't even push that limit. I said, I'm at my limit, I'm done. So this past year, when I went in and I had almost very similar issues, I had actually cultivated, like, I knew the difference, right? I knew I was in a bad place. I knew that I had to work the problem, but I also knew that I have come through that situation and continued to kind of like, and then, you know, rise up and have a good time. But I had to learn that lesson the hard way. And so I don't think stubbornness alone can be a replacement for all of those things, but I think it, you know, it has to be utilized very intelligently.
You know, so often ultra runners are thought of as tough, and, or at least I'm going to define ultra runners as tough. Maybe those outside don't see it that way, but I do. That we can work through anything, and that we're tough, and we just must drive through this, and it's going to get better. But that's not always the case. You have to be smart enough to recognize when you need to make some major changes in your day so that you can make it to that finish line. I mean, as Ann Trason had shared with us on a podcast, that it's the best decision. That's a word. I'm stubborn. Yeah. I'm going to get it said. Decision makers that make the best runners, people that think on their feet.
You know, I have a definition that I found as I was kind of thinking about this and researching it, and it was a definition that someone gave resilience as it contrasts to stubborn. He said resilience is about not getting the highs and lows of endurance, not letting that affect you as much, whereas stubborn is just not giving up. Resilience is not letting, you know, the highs and lows of a training cycle or a race really affect you. You have a focus and you just don't let it affect you. You make adjustments. Where stubborn is just pure unadulterated, I'm not going to give up. I don't know if there's a difference there. What do you think?
I think you confused me, but I'm with you.
Don's face started contorting as I was talking about that.
I've got an example to help straighten out Scott's example.
Thank you very much, Andy.
It spins off of Devin's story right there of resilience and taking that experience and learning from it and then calling it into action. This past year at Western States did remind me of 2004 at Angeles Crest when I ended up getting acute renal failure and had 8 days in the hospital and, you know, was worried for the future of my kidneys. The reason I ended up in the emergency room and in the hospital was because I was stubborn, right? I refused to, you know, give in to the pain in my legs and so on and so forth. When I came out the other side, the doctor said to me, you know, in order to be successful and continue to do these things, you can either, you know, go slower when you start to feel the pain or train harder so you don't feel the pain. And obviously I chose the second one, and that then led to using stubbornness as a strength. So I had this negative experience of getting acute renal failure and a wife, my lovely wife, Shelley, of 25 years, telling me, don't you ever get that again, or if you do, you're never running again, as incentive to train stubbornly, if you will, and in a way that was resilient, Scott, so that it wouldn't happen again. And that's the kind of thing that where Devin's talking about, using that time to switch your stubborn muscle on and stubborn muscle off. Stubborn muscles are like the rest of our, they have to be developed. And I think if they are, you know, things like that can happen. And you can use those negative experiences that are perhaps the result of stubbornness and turn them into positives.
So how do you develop those stubborn muscles? What do you do? Can you do it during training? Is it just during races? When do you use these?
Hey, Devin, I got to ask you, because you had to have. Activated your stubborn muscle at Last Chance this past year at Western States.
So
explain a little bit, like, how did that get activated aside from the fact you were sitting there for a while and it was like you could either, you know, it was your Rubicon, you could either get up off that chair and, you know.
Hey, let's before you answer that, Devin, let's recount what happened. Andy, you're a storyteller. Tell us what happened.
I want to know what Andy's version of the story is.
It didn't happen to Andy, but he's going to tell the story.
Oh, no, but of course, I was an observer of the race and an astute observer of it. And I had been out on the course about mile 17 and saw Devin. She was running along with Casey in the women's lead at the time, and then saw her again come into Robinson Flat mile 30, you know, just a few minutes behind in second place. And, you know, then words started to trickle through the, you know, crowd that Devin was having a rough time kind of going into and out of dusty corners at mile 38. And then a report back that she'd spent a fair amount of time sitting in a chair at Last Chance, which is at mile 43, right before the, you know, you descend into the Deadwood Canyon and then El Dorado Canyon and so forth. And, you know, it was just an interesting thing to encounter at the time as an observer, because then fast forward to, you know, an hour and a half later, Devin popped out of El Dorado Canyon at Michigan Bluff, a mile 55, and was back to normal and it was back to game on. and was asking, you know, and truly was asking about how the other runners were doing, you know, her friend Wyo and others, you know, seeing how the race was progressing. So you had a pretty quick turnaround somehow, but I imagine it didn't feel quick in the moment. And then, of course, you know, the wonderful film came out that Billy Yang made, Life in a Day, and Devin told that marvelous story of, you know, of all people, Craig Thornley, the race director, having to be there, happening to be there at Last Chance and so on and so forth. So I've been dying since I saw the movie to ask you in person what was going on the inside in that moment. Because in relative terms, 12 miles later is not that much later. And yet in the course of a race, it was probably a lifetime of flipping that switch.
Yeah. As you saw in the film, I think it might have, there's two films about Western states, and I don't know which one I said it in, but there's a moment before the race when I'm talking to my crew saying, like, there's going to come a moment. I know there's going to come a moment where I have this, like, super convinced I want to stop type of feeling. I had hoped it would just be like a mental, you know, this is hard kind of thing. It's not like a, I missed my crew and was out of water and out of fuel kind of situation. But when I was sitting there, like, I had that in my mind, like, I want to quit, but I know that this is just the moment that I am thinking that, like, I've been here before. I did that when I ran at Javelina and ran the third fastest time, North American, blah, 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 whatever. You know, I had a moment there too. And then I ran a 14:52, right? So I think when I was sitting in the chair, like, I'm like, I know that this is just that moment. And I also know that I have the mantra, work the problem, right? So I know that this moment's going to come. I'm trying to figure out what the problem is and to get my bot, like, I'm like, this is very much physical,
ooh,
right?
Oh, hold on. Go ahead. We just lost you on Skype. Now we have you. Go ahead.
Okay. You know, and I'm in that moment going, I don't know how to keep going. And, you know, Craig Thornley did, and Billy both were like, you know, you can do this. And it was really that reminder where, like, in my head, I've already said, like, dropping is not a choice that I'm going to make unless I'm literally, like, being pulled off the course. Like, I don't care if I have to walk. I don't care what it is. And, like, I just needed to take that moment to, like, give myself credit for my ability to come back out of that moment so that then, that, like, essentially, like, let the stubbornness and let the decision that I had made before the race to have whatever day that I was going to have, like, I had to accept that moment, right? And that's where that stubbornness kicked in, is just realizing I was having one day. I was having a great day. Casey and I were running along, singing musicals together, you know, having this amazing day. And then my day shifted to something else. And so literally, I think it was getting back to that idea of what my number one, like, guiding principle for the race was. And that's when I said, you know what, like, I'm working the problem. I'm doing the things that it takes to get out of the chair physically. And now I just need to, like, get over, like, that mental hurdle of a changing experience. And then I realized, like, I'm going to be fine. And so I just have, like, I literally walked out of the aid station and I started going down in the canyons, which I had trained on a lot. And suddenly it was just like, I can do this. I'm fine. And so it just took that kind of shift in my mentality to kind of get that back.
We need to take a little side trail here. I need to know what musicals you and Casey were singing. Are these Broadway musicals? Are we talking Wicked? Are we talking Les Mis?
We're singing. It was more like Lion King, kind of.
What I envisioned was you and Casey doing a duet from Frozen, and going back and forth, just for my own mental image. So
that works. That's about approximately what it would have been.
So can you? I just think that's funny. Here are the top two females running for the title of Western States first place, and they're singing musicals on the trail.
Yeah,
you don't get that in triathlons.
Well, yeah, but I think that's one of the things that I, you know, love about ultra running is, like, that part of the, that's as much a part of the experience as focus and stubbornness and resilience and making good decisions. It's also, like, working together with other people.
And sometimes competitors. Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, with all this talk about different genders in ultra running, for sure the guys were not singing musicals.
Yeah, and, I don't think Holmesley and Sage were singing. Yeah.
And I think maybe they should have been.
Lesson learned.
We'll throw that out there for him. Hey, you know, you ran Javelina with a 14:52 finish, but had a rough spot in that race. Maybe speak to that. Let's just throw it around the table. Rough spots, but still coming out with stellar days. Days that are marked down in a record book, either a personal record book or a record book, yet still having just an awful spot in the middle. Very doable. And have you had some races that you've passed through that spot, but still come out with a great day?
Oh yeah, I mean, not you know, that fast. But I have certainly had those races that I consider a success today that were miserable and had long stretches of misery in the midst of it. But probably the most glaring one was Western States in 2006. I kind of came in undertrained because I'd gotten banged up a couple months before, and only, you know, fortunately it was just a brutally hot day, and so there was a lot of carnage in the field. But yes, the entire middle part of the day, from Last Chance, where we were just talking about Devin having her low point, all the way through to Forest Hill. I mean, it was only because I was running with my old friend and mentor, Tom Nielsen, who we encountered each other leaving Last Chance and basically talked to each other and said, well, we're going to throw our splits out the window and we're going to just let's drag each other through this. And I dragged the downhills and he dragged the uphills, and misery loves company, I suppose. And it was only after Forest Hill and then the trip down to the river where we started feeling a little bit back to life. And I think we're able to run pretty good splits and both finish, you know, respectively in the top 10 that year. But I mean, certainly at mile 40, I was thinking, all right, well, there goes my top 10 streak. It's out the window. And, you know, and it was a definite turnaround. I will say it was a little bit of stubbornness that helped turn that around, but also more of a belief of optimism that it will definitely get better. I mean, it has to get better. It's really bad right now, but it has to get better. And, you know, thinking of Devin when I saw her at Michigan Bluff, that had to have been a little bit of what happened, because she got down into, you know, Deadwood and it started getting better. So sometimes stubbornness can lead to optimism in an ironic sort of twist.
I don't want to get away from the topic of stubborn, but how soon can you recognize when a day is starting to go south? Compared to when you were a rookie and you started out, things just kind of happen to you and you experience them and you reflect back and you look back and say, man, when that happens, this is the direction I'm going. But now as veterans, how quick can you recognize a problem coming on? Devin.
When I was a rookie, I think I tended to actually freak out sooner that things were not because my running career started and it was like all PRs and all amazing. And like, I really I had no bad races when I was first starting. I just didn't know what I was doing. So when I first started really getting into it, if I didn't feel magical, every time I started out in a race, I would be like, oh my God, it's going to be a terrible day. And now I've learned to temper that, to kind of know that sometimes it does take me, I don't know, a full marathon or 50K or half the race to actually start feeling better, that I can literally run 2/3 of a race and then be like, oh, okay, I'm actually good. So
that's very interesting.
I think it can happen almost immediately. And yet instead of you have to have the self-talk. And so Don, you said, when do you know a race is going south? Well, as soon as you feel like it's going south, you need to tell yourself it's not going south. And you need to stop making it go south. So let's say, you know, you're just going up the first climb at Western States and your heart rate is higher than you think it is. And all these people are blasting by you. You just have to accept that that's what the day is giving you. And maybe, you know, 30 miles down the trail, it'll give something back. But you have to, I think, to be in the right mindset to race ultra marathons, you from the starting gun need to be monitoring yourself. And the bigger mistake is, you know, to think everything's going to be great all the time. You know, in fact, you're probably better off thinking going into a race, thinking, okay, what can go wrong? I need to be prepared for the five or six things that can go wrong that I can control, and then hope that the 20 other things that can go wrong that I can't control don't happen to me. But I think a lot of mistakes are made with people thinking they can do more than they actually can, or wanting to do more than they actually can, or most of all, worrying about what everybody else around them is doing and how they compare. And so I think you've got to stay internal and keep asking yourself those questions. And, you know, whether it's going to go south or north, you're going to know pretty quickly. And it's not even that for a race. It could be for your neighborhood 8-mile training run. I mean, we've talked about this on the show before. You know, sometimes you can tell within 20 strides of starting your run on a regular old training day, whether you have spring in your step or not, or whether that dinner last night was a little too much. And I think those are the things that come with experience and time and learning from yourself.
So how do you know when to give up? So as I think of the word stubborn and knowing, at what point do you just keep the blinders on and say, you know what? No, I'm gonna work through this, versus maybe opening your vision a little bit to what you're feeling, internal feedback, and maybe some feedback from those around you where they're saying, today's not your day. You're putting yourself at long-term risk if you continue. How do you know when to give up?
When to tap out, when to cut the wristband and call it a day.
Right. Mm. There's a fine line, I think, between being stubborn and putting the blinders on and risking something.
Yeah, I'll throw something out there. Yeah. Kevin Sawchuk, mile 55, again, Western States is the reference point, and he said, and I tried to convince him that I shouldn't be running that day.
He was stubborn.
He was stubborn when I wasn't stubborn. I thank him for that finish. And he said, you're not stopping at my aid station. You just walk to the next one. If you have to walk, just walk it and cut the bib or the ribbon or your wristband there, but not here. And so I think sometimes just backing off your expectations and if there's nothing wrong with you, if there isn't something metabolically crashing and you're going to end up in an ambulance like some runners can if they don't observe their health. It was just more me feeling sorry for myself. And I think when you feel sorry for yourself, that's unacceptable. Down the road you go. But if there's something physically wrong with you, you get a pass. You don't have to finish. Those are my thoughts.
And while you're formulating your answer, Devin and AJW, I want to maybe, you know, put a little context to this. You know, recently I ran a race that I didn't finish, mm-hmm. and it was a short race.
Yeah.
And I still look back on it and I think, should I have dropped? And I think if I was stubborn, really nothing was wrong with me. I mean, I was having some cramping issues and it hurt, but I think, should I have continued? Should I have been stubborn and continued, or was it the right decision? But from my internal feedback, nobody externally was telling me you look terrible. You shouldn't continue on. So that's the perspective I'm coming from with this question.
Devin. I have a really good recent example because, you know, I'm coming back from an injury that lasted, you know, 6 months ish, and I lined up at Two Oceans knowing that I had absolutely no idea what the day could hold for me. Like I literally was basically running like 15 miles longer than I had done most of my training runs at. And from the I got in the right place mentally to like reduce my expectations to get on the starting line. But as soon as the gun went off, I was like, oh God, what have I done? I have to run 56K. There's gale force winds. This is a hard course. What am I doing? And I literally wanted to quit like 48 out of 56K. My mind was just like, you have plenty of reason. Like, you just broke your foot. You just like, you're not trained for this. Like, I literally had a constant like stream of thoughts in my head about wanting to quit. Right. And I literally was like looking for team, like people from my team so that I could just get in their car. And luckily for me, none of them were there because I realized at a certain point that it was just like, even though I had said, oh, I'm willing to, you know, do whatever it takes to get to the finish line, not knowing, the ambiguity to me of, what that was actually going to hold. And, I was like, my foot could blow up. I haven't run this far. All of the normal things could happen. And then there came a point where I realized that my team just wasn't coming. I was not going to see anybody. And it was funny because at that moment when I realized, I am finishing this race, I'm actually going to, I was stubborn enough to get to the point where it did change. And so I realized, I had just been trying to come up with a reason to stop because it was hard. And I it was hard. It was 56K when I haven't done the training. But I started passing people. I felt great. I had a really great finish, and it was in part because I was able to give myself the time to see the difference between just mental noise of this is hard, I want to quit, and true physical problems. I was monitoring my foot. If my foot had started to hurt in a way that would be detrimental to my long-term health, I would have stopped. But it wasn't hurting in a way that would actually make me make that choice, except for if I was giving into that mental noise. And there is a, like you said, there is a difference between, causing physical harm. But I think that's where the experience comes in, is to know the difference. And I ran Boston Marathon in 2015. It was the year after the bombing, and I got there and I had I was really sick, but I was I'm gonna be stubborn, I'm running this race anyways. And I went out, and by mile 10 my lungs were filled with fluid and I just literally couldn't breathe. And I had that moment where I was I'll just be stubborn, and I was or I'm gonna give myself pneumonia and not be able to run. And I ended up dropping out of that race because it was very clear to me that I was making a poor choice for my health. And I think you learn some of that through experience. I think there's definitely always times when it is a gray area, where you're is this a major problem, or is this something that is a problem and I'm I'm not able to access my ability to work through that problem, or am I not giving enough patience?
You mentioned the words talking to yourself, and boy, finding, searching for an excuse that is credible, not only to yourself, but to your crew, or maybe somebody that you're going to text later. Something, does this hold water? Would this pass as a decent excuse? And you have to really search hard when you're out there. You've got to somehow get that out of your head. Those negative words, how do you change that? How do you change that conversation in your own mind?
In Devin's case, it changed because she didn't have any other option. It was forced upon her to change her voice, right?
Yeah.
I like that.
I also was running with a friend of mine who's a trail runner, and he, at 3K, he just magically appeared at my side, and I was like, oh, thank God. And I would just periodically be like, yep, I still want to quit. And he'd be like, you're not quitting. And to have that, he's like, we're way faster than we should be, so we could slow down, and but you're not quitting. And to have that counterforce to kind of be like, realistically, a lot of that noise, what I've realized in the last couple of years is that you don't necessarily do away with the negative thoughts. It's, I think experience teaches you to give them less credit for being true, and just being like, that's noise. That's just my mind being occupied by doing something hard, versus it being like, this is a fact, I feel bad, or I want to quit, so I should quit. And it's like, it's just noise. It's just your mind working.
Yeah, AJW, negative chatter or any other topic?
I've thought a ton about this topic, and of all the debates, the internal debates that have gone, clanging around in my head all these years of running ultras, the one I keep coming back to is the debate between acceptance and denial. And I think if you push too hard to one side or the other, if you accept too much, you probably drop out more than your fair share. If you deny too much, you probably run yourself into the ground and perhaps even into career-ending injuries. I think when you're in that process of absolute denial, I'm not in pain, I'm not going to drop out, I'm not going to, sometimes the little birds of acceptance need to chirp a little bit louder. And perhaps, Scotty, in your case, you were ready to accept the drop in that race the other day. And for whatever reason, you know, maybe it was the right decision. Maybe it was the wrong one. Only you will know that. But thinking about acceptance and denial, not only in the context of running, but in life, is where you want to calibrate this your stubbornness muscle also. Because you want to find some place, some sweet spot, some gray area in the middle between acceptance and denial. And that's where you want to spend most of your time. And whether it's during the course of one race, you know, as the birds of acceptance were hitting Devin and on that chair of at Last Chance, and then the birds of denial came back and said, no, I'm going to get up. Or Sawchuck said to you, no, you're not going to stop here at Michigan Bluff. Just walk your sorry ass to Forest Hill. You know, I think sometimes other people can help spark that stubbornness that get us through. So the debate between acceptance and denial is one that clangs around in all of our heads in lots of different ways and is worth listening to.
You know, we talk about stubborn as a way to describe being tough and to push through, but maybe perhaps stubborn is to stay on plan and not be wavered or pushed away from your I'm going to hydrate. I'm not going to push the hills. I'm not going to chase that particular competitor. I'm going to run my own race. That's another stubborn of being a disciplined runner. What do you think of that?
I think
they're shaking their heads. Just you're at home. Listen.
Yeah, we have to speak.
And I think they were in agreement.
I definitely agree with that because I think that is also a skill that you have to practice. And you know, as a young runner, you get caught up in like wanting to run somebody else's race or do something else. But you know, the races that I have had the greatest success with have been the ones that I, you know, had that discipline to hold to plan and to not just, you know, get out there and throw everything out the window. You know, it's the races where I didn't have that, where I threw everything out the window, that ended up going to, I can't swear on your podcast, Kane, just the ones that have gone the worst.
So are there some races that you've been pushed out of your game plan and went out a little faster and the race turned out better? That goes to both of you guys. You run up front, both of you. Have you had an original plan, found a competitor that was a little bit swifter and starting off a little bit faster, and you said, screw it, I'm going with them, and it worked out better?
Well,
I have to go back. You know, I had spent about 5-6 years in from about 2002 to 2007, getting quite a few second place finishes in various races, and I was getting to the point where I was almost desperate to get a win in a race, just any race, any win, just to feel what it's like to go across the finish line first. And you know, that moment finally came in Vermont at 2007. And where I went out of my comfort zone was not necessarily going out with somebody and sticking with them and throwing out the game plan. It was going into the lead. I had never been in a 100-mile race. And I'd been kind of, there were four of us kind of running back and forth the first 30 miles and get to the main aid station, Camp Ten Bear, at like 40. And those guys were monkeying around with their stuff. And I left the aid station before they did and started running. And as that proceeded, I just kept running and never got caught by another person. So I ran in the lead for 60 miles. And I'd never, ever done that before. And frankly, haven't done very much since. But it was just an extraordinary feeling of being out, completely out of a comfort zone, since I'd been sort of the guy who picked off the carnage at the end type of runner before then, where I just was in completely uncharted territory and learned a ton from it, a ton. So in the few other races that I did manage to win, I was able to, you know, channel that experience and do okay in that context. But, you know, it's funny to think about now because, you know, I was winning a race and I was more scared than I'd been in any other race. And that taught me a lot.
Devin, I want to hear your comments on this. You've been up front before.
Yeah, actually, my two biggest examples of throwing plan out the window are both marathons, including my personal best at the 2012 trials. I ended up running a 2:38, and I actually took my watch off and threw it to a random ultra running friend in the crowd because I was like, and I was, I went out with, you know, professional marathoners. Like, I went just out and just was like, I'm going to embrace this experience. I'm running faster than planned, faster than I've ever run by like 5 minutes. And when you're running that fast, 5 minutes is a lot. And I just embraced it. I was like, this could really hurt at some point. But I also realized that I would never know what my limit was in terms of actually going for it. You know, I think one of the things that I've tried to, that I've worked on trying to figure out is with ultra running, the perspective is all, often like how to stay comfortable so that you don't implode at certain points. And what I've actually discovered is I don't always want to stay in that safe zone. You know, I don't always want to run the plan of the time that I know I can do. And sometimes I just want to go for it. And actually at Javelina, there came a point in the last 40 miles where I passed Carl Meltzer going into the last full loop. And EO is pacing me. So we're smashing along and we go by him and he's like, I'll see you later. I had like 20 miles left. So it was like my 80. So he was saying that I was going to blow up. And I was like, all right, bet. And I just, I know I was like 3 hours ahead. You know, I was, you know, I was ahead of like Casey's course record pace. By all bets, I could have just like throttled off. But I went away from my plan of saying, I know I can run this time. And I said, I want to see actually if I can break myself. And so I went to like, kind of to see where I could push that limit and just see if I could like essentially reach that limit that I wouldn't have known if I had stayed on plan. And I mean, I ended up actually like dropping EO, which is the only time I've ever run with her and actually like dropped her. Like she actually stopped and I did the last section by myself. And because I was just like, I'm going to see where I can go with this and see if I can find my limit. And I think that that's also like the value in not just being stubborn and sticking to your plan is sometimes being willing to take the risk to blow up.
This question to both of you, would you rather run in first place or second place and have an eye on the lead runner? And an eye meaning not necessarily see them, but know just where they are at any given time from good intel from your crew. Would you rather be in first place running for your life or second place being on the hunt? AJW first and then Devin.
Oh, the hunt, definitely. I mean, like I said, the few races that I did was fortunate enough to win. I was very excited too, but I was much, much rather just lurk in the background and come from behind. It's just a more comfortable place for me to be. And I think that's a little bit about, that says a lot about, you know, one's temperament and personality. I have as much confidence as the next guy, but I also never know what I don't know. And I'd rather be, you know, I'd rather see the world in front of me than, be looking over my shoulder. And I think that frankly is part of the way I kind of like to live my life, not just my running life, but the rest of my life. Much rather be coming from behind.
Devin, second place, chasing or running for your life?
Definitely chasing. It was actually funny when we weren't singing musicals together. Casey and I were actually discussing how weird it was that we were actually in lead and how uncomfortable that made us because we're like, are we doing something wrong? And that was why we're like, are we doing something wrong? We're running comfortable, right? And we're like, yeah, okay, we're running comfortable. But it made us super paranoid because we're like looking over our shoulder going, are we making a mistake right now? And honestly, like it was actually more motivating to me to try to like chase somebody down. I mean, the last 40 miles of Western States was so much fun for me because I was just trying to like dig myself out of this massive hole that I had from sitting there for 35, 40 minutes, you know? So it was really energizing versus I feel like sometimes when you feel like you're being hunted, it can just make you feel really uncomfortable and like you don't necessarily have that intel. It's not as motivating to me. I like to chase people down.
So how much more energy does it take to be a lead runner versus a second place chaser?
I mean, mental energy, it takes a ton. I mean, I've never been as mentally exhausted after that Vermont, my first one where I was running in the front for 60 miles. It just, running 100 miles on the rivet is mentally exhausting anyway. But doing it with a lead and, you don't know what's going on back there. You don't know who's, biding their time. You don't know. It's tough. So that was, wore me out mentally way more than kind of sitting back and waiting till Forest Hill and then picking people off.
Yeah, Devin. I agree. I definitely agree that the mental energy, I think when you're leading, you're trying to figure out what's going on. You're spending all the time figuring out imagining all the scenarios of what are happening behind you. When you're settled into kind of a hunting position, you don't have that same thought process.
But at the same time, I have spoken to people. I mean, I remember speaking specifically to Hal Kerner after he won his first Western States, and Ann Trason, recently, about the two of them wanted to run off the front, wanted to get off the front so that no one else dictated their race. Now that, of course, takes a lot of confidence because you got to know you can get off the front in the first place. But it's a lot, for example, the way Matt Carpenter ran the Leadville 100 when he set that course record. And so I think there are different personalities and mindsets and temperaments that would prefer to be off the front and maybe find that relaxing. That's just not me.
I want to go back to the definition of stubborn.
Oh, yeah. Get us back on topic.
This is
stubborn. Yeah, podcast.
This is completely on topic, but I think that I have a better understanding of this definition now. So the definition that we read at the beginning of the program says, having or showing a dogged determination not to change one's attitude or position on something, especially in spite of good arguments or reasons to do so. So when I first read that, I thought the way I understood it was you have blinders on, you're not paying attention to anybody's feedback, including your own internal feedback. But I think that it's not banging your head on the wall, knowing the wall is never going to break down and that you're just going to end up giving yourself a headache. I think it is banging your head on the wall, knowing and having hope that what you're doing is you're making progress in breaking that wall down. If there is no hope or if there is no evidence that you're going to be breaking that wall down, then there's an issue. But I think with the definition that I think that understanding of the definition that I've gotten is you still hit your head on the wall as long as you have some kind of hope or evidence that the wall's moving. Would you agree with that?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I love it when everybody is just,
no, that's a stupid comment. Can we edit that out?
Oh, yeah. Hitting your head against the wall.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one, Scott.
You lost
that's
me hitting a good one. My head against the wall.
You can see, I have a big red mark on my forehead.
I do think, it is a good point that in spite of the external factors saying stop or slow down or do something else, the most stubborn, don't even, they basically ignore those factors or block them out or have some sort of mental trick to making sure it doesn't, it doesn't impact them. But I agree. I mean, I think it does make sense that the most successful people at, being resilient and persistent and stubborn are those who are able to, be almost one dimensional in their focus when they need to be.
Scott, I've got to say I really appreciate you rereading that description, and maybe we'll make it part of our show intro in the
because
future.
It got us.
It really moved us.
Really moved everybody.
So an ultra runner is historically an optimist, I think.
Yes.
There's positive energy out there and always looking towards the good. Because if somebody's negative, you talk yourself right out of the sport in a second. And one of the things I like about the community is the optimism. Just people are positive, and I like positive people.
Or back to Devin's point, trying to reach outer limits. What is possible for me personally? I'm going beyond anything that I know, but I want to see what's out there.
So an interesting combination of characteristics. You need to be stubborn. You need to be positive. You need to be, you know, determined. I mean, there's a lot of things that make up the ultra runner, and some of them you don't always associate with one another. It's an interesting recipe for ultra runners. Yep. There's another show stopper.
There's. Yes.
Yep, that's good. We've never had a podcast.
This is an audio podcast. We don't see you nodding.
Yeah. So let me be AJW at this point. You know, I've thought a lot about that point. You know, over the years, I've written on it, I've talked about it, and I've come to this conclusion. You can start with something like that, AJW,
and eventually something will come to you.
Anything coming to you, AJW? No.
You're right. The recipe of what can be occasionally diametrically opposed concepts is part of what makes a successful ultra runner. You need to be stubborn and optimistic, right? You need to be open-minded and singularly focused, right? So I think that there are aspects of the sport that are a wonderful as a, you know, microcosm for life and in ways in which we need to find answers to challenging problems. I do think, though, at the end of the day, most of these characteristics that make good ultra runners are like stubborn, like vulnerable, are traits that in other parts of society are not necessarily seen as positives. And that's, you know, I think a valuable lesson of this concept and this idea.
That was good. Hey, Devin, what do you think about cross training?
What? Where did that come from?
I don't know. I'm just trying to save this thing. We're like a sinking ship. We need somebody to row this thing.
I can say something about the combination of traits if you want.
Oh, good. Yes, please. Thank you.
I mean, I've now been doing ultras for 11 years, and one of the things that I've seen with the people who have lasted in the sport is the people who last in the sport do have like more than one skill to draw upon, because I think, you know, we've seen a lot of people in recent years come into the sport, and Megan Arbogast calls them visitors to the sport, like where somebody comes in, they, you know, shine really bright and then you don't hear from them again. I think it's like, you have to find a different way to approach it. If one, you know, one way is not working, like people who have lasted in the sport have come at it from different perspectives and used kind of a larger bag of skills to kind of like work through those issues. So I do think that you have to have more than just stubbornness. I think stubbornness is a good starting point, but I think as we've explored talking about this, like there are other things that play into that. And it's kind of deeper than just having that trait. It's a trait that is informed by experience and by other traits.
Yeah, the takeaway for me from this was when Andy put up his arm and said, "You're stubborn muscle. When do you flex it? You really have to know when to push that button. I need to be stubborn, or I need to pull back a little bit,
or use a different muscle."
Right. And so I think stubborn is key, and it's not always negative. It can be positive.
Yeah.
And there's two ways to look at that word, and I think it's important to stay stubborn.
Well, and I think Devin's comment and sharing Megan's notion of visitors, I've talked with Megan a lot and others about that too, this the coming and going versus the folks who've been in it for a long time. And I've often thought it would be an interesting study to get people you know, who've been in the sport for, you know, 8 years or longer, and do a little bit of a focus group on their temperament, their personality, their emotional makeup, their, you know, their lifestyles. And you might find quite a few common characteristics. And I would have to imagine stubbornness would absolutely be on that list. But also this idea of needing to blend together what might be disparate skills that you call on at different times for different reasons to solve different problems. And that's probably an interesting topic for a future a podcast. But of course, Devin, as a professional baker, knows that sometimes you mix together ingredients that may not necessarily on the surface go together. But when they blend together in just the right way, they're like cuisine genius. And sometimes that happens in the sport as well.
Cuisine genius. That's going in the show notes.
Devin, do you have a secret recipe for some trail food that you use, or as a baker, a professional baker, do you put something together?
No, I've experimented with a lot of different things in nutrition, and I found that my secret recipe is simplicity. So that is like, I basically ran javelina on all tailwind. So I save my secret recipes for after the fact. I pretty much can spend most of my ultras thinking about what special thing I'm going to eat afterwards, but I don't tend to put that into my race.
Is there a go-to treat for the finish line, Devin?
Not necessarily for the finish line, but after javelina, I had a carrot cake and whiskey party. So that is probably
that goes
best.
Together well.
Yeah, especially when all of your
carrot
friends
cake
bring
and whiskey.
Well, you know, yeah, we had. I like a good whiskey cocktail. So,
AJW, is that where you're going with this, Scott?
Well, I know what AJW's is.
Oh, an IPA,
an IPA. Here. Yeah. Or two.
And a cheese.
One in each hand.
And a cheeseburger.
Yeah, yeah. You may try some carrot cake next time. Well, this has been an interesting discussion. I went into this discussion thinking there was no positive connotation to stubborn. And I think that you guys have altered my perception and have shed some light on making stubborn a more positive, optimistic trait that I need to search for.
Devin, what's up next for you? You got a race coming up you want to share with us? How do we get a hold of you if we're interested in following you on Strava or Instagram or whatever you do?
I'm doing Comrades on June 4th. uphill year. So that's exciting-ish. Strava, I don't know what, you can find me on Strava, just look up my name. You just Google me. I don't know.
it's that easy thing. Google it.
Yeah. Yeah. How about your
and if
AJW?
You're in the Bay Area, go to the bakery for sure.
Yeah. Give that a plug. Where is that bakery?
We are in San Anselmo, which is Marin. The name of my bakery is MH Bread and Butter.
Oh, good. I'm there from time to time. That's good. I'm going to stop in and sample.
You should.
AJW, what's up for you? Are you doing some coaching? What about a run?
I'm heading out to Bighorn as a training run for the Tahoe 200. And I'm going to do Bighorn. You know, I've had this whole life of being able to run with my wife and kids as my crew, and they are all abandoning me for Bighorn. They have clearly passed me by. And so I'm going to do Bighorn, you know, no pacer, no crew, do it all old school, drop bags and stuff, and see how that goes. But I'm looking forward to it.
Nice, nice. Scott?
Hey, just one little curious note before we close and wrap this thing up. Devin, you're a baker. What is your view on carbs? or is that a topic for another podcast?
I believe that everybody should do self-experimentation and find out what works for them.
Perfect.
That's what I think.
That's a very political answer. Very nice.
And pro for customers.
Yes.
Pro carbs.
Yeah.
Now go out and run.
Very pro fried egg sandwich.
Fried egg sandwich.
Ooh, good.
Ooh, that sounds good. Maybe I'll have that for lunch.
A little mustard on it.
Go
out and be stubborn.
Moss. What's a